From Bureaus Worldwide, this is FSN.
Well done, Simon. Well done. How you doing? Thursday's programme, about to begin the 29th of October, 2020. It is myself, who else would it be? Live from Salford, it's been chucking it down, raining Datsun Cogs all day today. I've got two terrific guests for you today.
It's the BBG, not the BBC. You're listening to the Richie Allen Radio Show, live from Salford in Greater Manchester.
With me, big baldy head and me. Yeah.
It's the Richie Allen Show, broadcasting live on richieallen.co.uk and multiple platforms around the world. And now, here's your host, Richie Allen.
Welcome. In the second hour of the program, I will be joined by none other than Leah Butler-Smith. It's about time I invited Leah Butler-Smith on. She's a psychotherapist and an activist. She became very well known in the summer when she was on national television explaining why she wouldn't wear masks. I like Leah. She'll be on with me in the second hour. We'll have a good old chin wag, so we will. Before that, the socialist and former MSP Tommy Sheridan. Tommy's a journalist and a broadcaster, very well known politician, and a good friend of ours. About time Tommy was back on the programme. He will be, well, providing his reaction to the news you just heard from Simon Marks. The news that Jeremy Corbyn, shortly after lunchtime today, was suspended by the Labour Party. Tommy Sheridan live this hour. There you are. All's good, all's well. I'm well. Are you well? Doesn't matter about me. Doesn't matter at all. Tickled pink by something the great Dr. Vernon Coleman told me today, but I can't tell you. What a tease I am. He told me something very funny. But if I was to tell you, it might give a clue as to the man's location. We can't have that. Lockdown, national lockdown is imminent. More on that shortly. To the Jeremy Corbyn news, the Equality and Human Rights Commission, that's the EHRC, report into Labour's handling of anti-Semitism complaints, that was published today, and it found Labour responsible for three breaches of the Equality Act: political interference in anti-Semitism complaints, failure to provide adequate training to those handling anti-Semitism complaints, and thirdly, harassment. The investigation found evidence of 23 instances of inappropriate involvement by Mr. Corbyn's office, including staff influencing decisions on suspensions or whether to investigate a claim. Shortly after the publication, Jeremy Corbyn had the whip removed and was suspended by the party. I don't know if there is a precedent for that. I don't know if he's the first former leader of a major political party to have the whip removed. I didn't have time to research it. But anyway, why did he have the whip removed, Jeremy Corbyn? Well, it was because of an interview he did with Sky News, whereupon he said this.
The numbers have been exaggerated, in my view. The public perception in an opinion poll last year was that one third of all Labour Party members were somehow or other under suspicion of anti-Semitism. The reality is it was 0.3% of party members had a case against them which had to be put through the process. And so I think it's clear that we do not accept, I do not accept, Keir Starmer does not accept, none of us accept anti-Semitism in any form whatsoever in our party.
But are you sorry that seemingly on this issue you failed to tackle it?
I don't believe I did fail. I believe that I brought in the rules that were necessary, and those are the ones that are now in operation, which means that the process is much more rapidly dealt with. But let's be clear about this. Racism is a poison and a cancer in our society. We all have to oppose it all the time, everywhere.
Keir Starmer said today, anyone who claims that this issue has been exaggerated should be nowhere near the Labour Party. Will you resign from the party?
Of course not.
Of course not, Sir Jeremy. Now, so he was suspended. This is a bit complicated now. Just before he was suspended and after he said there was anti-Semitism, but it was greatly exaggerated by his enemies, former Labour MP Luciana Berger, a Jewish woman herself, was on LBC with James O'Brien. O'Brien, who is so wretched there isn't a word in the Oxford Concise to describe him, speaks to Berger as if Corbyn had murdered her firstborn or ran off with his foreskin. Listen.
No, I have to ask for your response to Jeremy Corbyn's claim that the scale of the problem was dramatically overstated for political reasons. And I just, for the record, Luciana, I'm more uncomfortable asking you that.
He's more uncomfortable asking her a question. What a wetbag he is. What a douchebag. Ask the question, you virtue-signalling moron.
Than anyone else I've put it to today, for reasons that you've just outlined.
But ask the question!
But I must ask you.
Just ask the fucking thing!
I have no words for that response today.
All right. That's what I would have said. Fair enough, we'll move on.
That response is off the back of an extensive 18-month investigation by a statutory body that, as you pointed out at the start, was created by the Labour Party when it was in government. And that independent public body has found the Labour Party today guilty of serious failings, and it lays the blame squarely at the door of the Labour Party leadership, of which Jeremy Corbyn was at the helm.
Yeah, lovely. Ran away with her firstborn's foreskin. Yeah, I did say that. I was circumcised myself, by the way. I'm not Jewish. I don't know what I am, but I was circumcised. I think it's because my mother had or has OCD. I think she thought I would be getting wee-wee everywhere unless I was tidied up down there, if you understand. Bit too much information around dinner time. I get it. But it must have been agony. And to think they take children away from parents for feck all now. Risk of future emotional harm. What about ripping your foreskin off? What about penile torture? What about Mickey meddling? What about tallywhacker defacement? That's what my mother did to me. I must have memories of it. It must be affecting me. The melancholy I'm experiencing might not be down to lockdown. It might be because my willy was defiled for no reason, apart from my mum's OCD when I was younger. Anyway, later this afternoon, Keir Starmer explained why Jeremy just had to go.
I made it clear that we won't tolerate anti-Semitism or the denial of anti-Semitism through the suggestion that it's exaggerated or factional. And that's why I was disappointed with Jeremy Corbyn's response. And that is why appropriate action has been taken, which I fully support.
Now, he won't tolerate anti-Semitism, which is fair enough. Nobody should tolerate bigotry in any form. We all agree with that. We're all adults. But I won't tolerate the denial of it or anybody saying that it is exaggerated. That's where we are now. This is where we are. Yeah. You can't say, well, I'm not fond of anti-Semitism, but in my opinion, I think this is being a bit overstated. You're gone. That's it. You're out of here. Crazy times. More on this with Tommy Sheridan real soon. By the way, the most important line in today's EHRC, the Equality and Human Rights Commission, the most important line in the report reads thus. You ready? Our investigation found that the Labour Party breached the Equality Act 2010 by committing unlawful harassment through the acts of its agents in two of the complaints we investigated. It also concluded, and of course the news media is conveniently not discussing this, it also concluded that the Labour Party is not institutionally anti-Semitic. But forget about that. Jeremy Corbyn is suspended. 96,000 new cases a day in England. What could I be talking about? Well, the coronavirus plague. Yes, Imperial College London. I don't know what else I can say about Imperial College London. It's told us overnight that there are 96,000 cases a day in England. And if you don't do something about it, well, chaos will reign in England and millions of us will die. We need to lock down right now. Here's Imperial College London's Stephen Riley, Professor of Infectious Disease Dynamics, whatever the hell that means.
In the most affected regions, we see a strong signal of it spreading out from those younger ages into the older ages who, as you say, are more at risk of disease and death. It's growing quickly. Then if you're going to use more stringent interventions, the sooner you put them on, then the less time they'll need to be in place and the sooner and the lower level you'll be at when you come out of them. So just in general, when something's growing very quickly, sooner's better than later.
Mm. Yeah, sooner better than later. Sooner better than later. Hillary, Dr. Hillary. I was listening to them this morning talking about Christmas and cases, and I was channeling Glenn Campbell. I mentioned Dr. Vernon Coleman earlier on. Vernon can sing, by all accounts. I haven't heard any of his music, so I'll reserve judgment. But I'm thinking Glen Campbell, by the time we get to Christmas, cases will be rising. You'll find we can't go outside anymore. This is where we're going. If they lock down now, there'll be no getting out of it until the vaccines. Dr. Hilary Jones, a ridiculous little dude, who, as far as I know, and I stand to be corrected, hasn't practiced medicine for years. In fact, he's practiced and perfected the art of lounging around on Good Morning Britain sofas for over 20 years, and Lorraine Kelly's sofas too. Does he even see patients? I wouldn't trust Hillary to take my temperature today, to be honest. Do you think we should lock down now, Dr. Hillary? Asked his GMB colleagues.
I'm afraid I do.
Surprise, surprise!
Because we're not adequately and quickly enough controlling the number of cases. They're still rising. So, yes, we've put some areas into tier three, and the situation would be worse if we hadn't done that. People are saying, well, it hasn't made any difference. It would be worse if we hadn't done that. And other areas, we've still got fairly lax regulations that allow six different households, six people from different households to get together. That was never going to be, in my opinion, a very sensible way forward. And unless we stop different households getting together, the R rate is going to increase and the situation is going to get worse. So I think, yes, we have to be more draconian.
What? Is that a medical term? That did they teach you that in medical school, Dr. Hillary?
I think, yes, we have to be more draconian.
We have to be more draconian. That's what the doctor ordered.
And people, I'm sure, understand that in order to get the control of the virus, this is what has to be done.
Oh, celebrity death match. Bring it back. MTV, Vernon Coleman versus Hillary Jones. Vernon by a TKO in about 3.5 seconds would be my bet. 15 minutes past the hour, the Richie Allen Radio Show, the Thursday edition. Now, Dr. David Ratcliffe, Salford Royal, interestingly enough, because I can see Salford Royal from studio. It's back to me in studio. I can see Salford Royal. Yeah. I can walk to it in about 6 minutes. And I have friends there. They tell me it's pretty normal for this time of year, not too busy. But David Ratcliffe is an emergency room doctor, A&E. Spoke to Nicky Campbell this morning. Nicky said to him, how does today compare to March, Dr. David Ratcliffe?
Well, March, I would say at the moment, it feels harder. So in March, we were unprepared for what was coming, but we worked together really well as a team and we were really focused. And the rest of the system effectively went into major incident mode. And so the focus was purely on the COVID patients. And as you were talking about earlier in the programme, much of the population was not affected by COVID, but the small part of the population was severely affected. This wave is very different. And we are trying, as you've already mentioned, to maintain all our usual work on top of a different sort of presentation of COVID across a wider age range that's ramping up. So the last 2 weeks have become really hard. And I've got real concerns around how we're going to maintain elective work, how we're going to maintain our usual work on top of what we're trying to cope with in the emergency departments at the moment.
Now, Nicky could jump in. Nicky could jump in and say, ah, so you're worried that you won't be able to do elective surgery on cancer patients and other types of patients because you're going to prioritise COVID. But if you take every man, woman and child in the country that has had COVID, only 0.05% of those are in any danger of dying. So why would you prioritise COVID over those other things? But Nicky Campbell is as useless as tits on a boar. So of course he doesn't ask.
The moment. So I'd say it feels different and staff are tired this time. Much, much more so than the first time.
People needing cancer treatments as well. All sorts of terrible knock-on effects. But do we not know far more now how to treat this?
Oh, Jesus. Oh, God. What a boring question. The answer?
Oh, without a doubt. And I think that's part of the issue. So I'm much more optimistic about patients' treatment. Patients are coming in now, and previously where the situation was pretty dire, Patients are being treated. They're not going on ventilators. They're recovering. But that means more days in hospital. So if patients recover, they need to be cared for, and they need to be cared for more days. So effectively, each patient, the number of days each patient is in hospital is going to change. We're also much better prepared in terms of provision for things like cancer surgery and others. We have hospitals which are set up just to do that. We have, we're working on, last night I was working quite late, we were talking about surgical rotors, how we make sure we have clean sites that stay clean, and that we can keep all the urgent work going. So all the cancer work going, all the as much of diagnostic work as we can going. Whereas last time that was sort of put on hold, and this time a real priority is to try not to do that. That's not to say that this won't eat into elective work of the non-urgent kind.
What about flu? Now, there were quite encouraging signs in the Southern Hemisphere earlier this year that the flu season was very mild, maybe a knock-on effect of us being more diligent, assiduous, meticulous about our hand-washing and our social distancing. Might that be easier this time around?
Again, you could always ask, has flu been rebranded as COVID, Nikki? If you had any testiclay, if you had any Leo Rodi, and will Leo Rodi a good Nicholas? Apparently not. Here's the response.
Yeah, so the hope is, if vaccination is as good as it can be, if we get the coverage as good as we can be, that some of the other measures that we put into place will reduce the incidence of flu. And I think that we have to... We can't emphasise enough how important the social distancing, the face coverings, all those things are, not just for COVID, but for all infectious disease. And so all of that hopefully will reduce the number of flu cases. But if you imagine in the winter, we're already having a hard time, usually in the winter, and I think it's a little bit invisible to society sometimes how difficult it can be.
Get off. There's more of that, but we don't need to hear that, do we? The First Minister of Wales is a man called Mark Drakeford. And he gave an interview to Wales Online. It was tweeted to me by a listener. Was it Claire? It might have been Claire. It might have been another lady. Forgive me. I retweeted it. In the conversation he had, Mark Drakeford, with the Wales Online journalist, he said this, and I'm reading it verbatim. I'm reading it word for word. "There are tests," said the Welsh First Minister, "being prepared that will be much more like the instant result you get for a pregnancy test, which you will be able to use at home and get the result very quickly. If, the other side of Christmas, some of those tests have genuinely broken through and we are able to use them, then I think that will change the landscape as well, because we will be able to allow people to do things they are not able to do today, because you will be able to test them there and then and know if it is safe for them to take part. And this is the future. No temporary measure is this. No, the future. A pregnancy test type of thing, where little prick of your index finger, within a few seconds, you are either okay or you are currently symptomatic of something or other. Therefore, you can't see the brand new Tom Cruise film or go into the concert that you spent £200 on tickets for about 6 months ago. These are tyrants, these people. They should be tarred and feathered. They should be horsewhipped, ridden out of town on a rail. And I'm telling you, when the national lockdown comes in, as it will imminently, there'll be no releasing from it. Remember Nicola, Jimmy Cranky Sturgeon, talking about the danger of us opening up and emerging from our houses, blinking into the sunlight. Remember what she said.
But as we have released ourselves from lockdown, we've also released the virus from lockdown.
As we released ourselves from lockdown, we released the virus. We left lockdown too soon, said Jimmy Cranky, back when we left lockdown. Any so-called circuit breaker, national lockdown, introduced by them, won't be for 4 or 6 weeks. If you believe them, well, you're beneath contempt. Bruce Springsteen's new album, Letter to You, is magnificent. 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 It's magnifique. And there is a song on it called House of a Thousand Guitars. What a name for a song. I'm going to play the song. Coming out of it, I'll be joined by none other than Scotland's Tommy Sheridan, a great bloke and a good friend of ours. Here's the boss! Right, Bruce, the boss, Springsteen, that's from Letter to You, the brand new album from the man himself. Great album, by the way, great album. Although you judge it by much of today's music, I suppose, it isn't hard. Listen, let's welcome back, give him a big fanfare, we always do. Our time is limited today. Former MSP, of course, great socialist, great friend of this programme's, broadcaster and journalist, the one and only Tommy Sheridan. Welcome, Tommy, back to the programme. Tommy, thanks for taking the time out to speak to us today. How have things been for you before we talk about Jeremy Corbyn? How are you getting on?
Richie, always a pleasure to speak to you, brother. I've got to say the challenges of dealing with the COVID restrictions are very great for very many people. I, however, am one of the lucky ones, Richie. I have a lovely wife and daughter. I have a nice house. I've got a garden. I don't have anything like the pressures that millions and millions have trying to cope in small cooped up conditions and flats and high rise buildings, not able to get out and about. And obviously the economic pressures are now getting even worse because the support mechanism from the government has been slashed, and they should be ashamed of that. I get so pissed off, Richie, when I hear government telling me they can't afford to support the low paid workers that are getting laid off through no fault of their own. But nobody ever says, yeah, but we can afford nuclear weapons. Yeah. It's just ridiculous. So all of that gets my goat, mate. All of it irks me. But obviously today has added to the rising rage within my mind and within my heart.
No doubt. And just for listeners joining us who might be on their way back from work, even if they're working at home, the former leader of the Labour Party, Jeremy Corbyn, had the whip withdrawn today, suspended by the party, because of comments he made in an interview he gave with Sky News after the publication of the Equality and Human Rights Commission report into anti-Semitism and how it was dealt in the Labour Party. Jeremy Corbyn said very clearly, he said, one case of anti-Semitism is I don't know how he phrased it. I agreed with his phrasing of it. He said that one case is one too many, he said, but I believe that the accusations were overly exaggerated by the enemies of the Labour Party externally, but also people working within the Labour Party to undermine him. That's what he said. Tommy, I've been struggling. I'm not sure of any other case of a former leader of a major political party who later on had the whip withdrawn in this manner. Before giving us your own personal opinion on what's happened to Jeremy Corbyn, did you ever hear of anything like that before?
It's never happened in my lifetime, Richie. I'm quite a keen follower of history as well. I don't remember of reading of any of these types of occasions. I do feel that Jeremy's exact words today were that it was overstated, that the scale of anti-Semitism within the Labour Party had been, to quote him, dramatically overstated. And the guy is absolutely right, absolutely right. I've got a mixture of anger and I've also got a bit of disappointment in my heart, Richie, because anger at the way Jeremy's been treated. I think you've got the irony of ironies, haven't you? At number 10 right now, you've got a racist bigot who is out and out anti-working class and certainly is guilty of all sorts of Islamophobia and other racist actions. He's in number 10 when one of the most equality pursuing individuals in the planet, someone who's got a peerless record of fighting against inequalities and racism and anti-Semitism in the shape of Jeremy Corbyn, finds himself suspended from his own party. It's just ironic beyond belief. But my shade and my tinge of disappointment is this, Richie. Jeremy Corbyn, when he was a leader of the Labour Party, And we know that it was a fluke in terms of him winning the first time in 15. However, he stuck with it, and when he got re-elected in 16, he had a strong base to go on and actually clean out the Labour Party for the Tories in red that occupy the benches in Parliament. And instead of standing up to the right wing, instead of standing up to those who want to get away with saying that Israel should never be criticised, even though it's broken hundreds of UN resolutions, international laws, and commits crimes against humanity in relation to the Palestinian people every day of the week. Despite all of that, he refused to stand up to those who tried to equate criticism of Israel's apartheid and Israel's war crimes with anti-Semitism. There is no relationship between that. Criticising Israel for what they're doing to Palestine is a human duty. It's not anti-Semitism at all. And what Jeremy should have done is he should have stood beside the likes of Chris Williamson, who in February of 2019 was disgracefully suspended by the Labour Party for simply saying that the response of the Labour Party to anti-Semitism criticisms was over the top. He said that it had been led by the Israeli lobby, and it was designed not to tackle anti-Semitism, but to try and stop criticism of Israel. And he was absolutely right, and he was suspended for it. And I couldn't believe that Jeremy and John McDonnell stood by and saw a great socialist like Chris Williamson, former leader of Derby City Council, I seen them suspended, and they did nothing.
Nothing.
And of course, when you don't do anything against bullies, Richie, they get emboldened, and they think they can go further and further and further, and that's what they did to Jeremy. They undermined his 2017 election campaign. All the evidence now shows that Jeremy would have won. Jeremy would have been the Prime Minister of the UK in 2017 if it wasn't for those turncoats and traitors within the Labour Party who actively undermined his campaign.
We could talk about Ken Livingston as well, when Livingston talked about the Havre agreement, which is historically factual, and he was kind of thrown under a bus by Jeremy Corbyn as well. Tommy Sheridan is our guest. Two things, just there will be, you know, my own feelings about people like Boris Johnson. I couldn't despise a politician or a man any more than I despise Johnson. But his supporters listening to this might say, Johnson's comments about women wearing letterboxes and silly comments like that, immature comments about people's, you know, cultural dress, are clumsy and stupid and childish rather than being any evidence of institutional racism or racism within him. I mean, I totally agree with everything you said about Corbyn. But maybe Johnson's comments are just the comments of an idiot. Maybe it doesn't nail him as an absolute bona fide racist.
The only problem I have with that, Richie, is we're not talking about an idiot, are we? We're talking about a very well, publicly educated schoolboy who knows exactly what he's saying, and he knows why he says it as well. These are nothing more than wolf whistles to try and stir up the type of racial division and hatred which he never ever suffers from, because he doesn't live in the working class areas where the type of racial attacks take place. But he knew what he was doing when he said these things, and I don't for a minute believe that he is just an idiot. I think he is a very cunning and sly man who knows exactly what he's saying.
Fair enough. Luciana Berger did a number of television interviews today, and I suppose the older I get, and I know you do this as well, I try to leave my own opinion to one side and kind of park my prejudice, if I have a prejudice, and try to see things through somebody else's eyes. And I get the impression that Luciana Berger, no matter what anybody might think of her, I get the impression that she believes what it is that she's saying, that she believes it. She believes that, you know, Labour wasn't a nice place to be under Jeremy, that genuine anti-Semites, genuine haters of Jewish people became emboldened when Jeremy became elected. Not because Jeremy is anti-Semitic or is a hater of Jews, because I agree with every word you said, but they thought there was an opening for for them. And she's also said, has Berger and one or two other Jewish Labour people, that people like me and people like you who've been, you know, advocating for the rights of Palestine and Palestinians for years, that we reserve a special place in terms of when we go criticising Israel, we criticise Israel in a way and in a manner that we don't do with Saudi Arabia, or that we don't do with North Korea, or that we don't do with even US imperialism. Does she have a point? I mean, I've been asking myself that question today. Do I give Israel special treatment when I point both barrels at Israel, which I do a lot? What do you think?
I'm sorry, Richie. I've got absolutely no time for Lucianna Berger whatsoever. I think she talks a pile of pish. I think she is completely and utterly in the pockets of the Israeli Zionist lobby. I think she is a neoliberal Tory who should never have been in the Labour Party if she was if she wanted to be a socialist. The fact that she's joined the Lib Dems says it all to me. And from my point of view, none of the accusations she levelled against her local party were ever substantiated. She spread lies. She spread manure, and she knew the stink would be great. And she got on the media because the BBC gave a platform to all of the pro-Israel comments that were getting made, because it's a very powerful lobby. And what she has done was a disgrace. She was dishonest, she was deceitful, and therefore I've got absolutely no time for her whatsoever. The truth is, Richie, whether we like it or not, the Israeli lobby in British politics and American politics is extremely powerful. And what they have done is they have managed to try and crucify people like Jeremy Corbyn, people like Chris Williamson, people like Ken Livingstone, who don't have an anti-Semitic bone in their bodies. These people are not racist or anti-Semitic at all. They've been out in the streets fighting the Nazis, fighting against anti-Semitism all their bloody lives, and now we find them accused of it. It is madness, absolute madness, Richie.
And is the consequence of what we've seen, and look, I take that argument on board, and I wasn't suggesting that I believe Lucianna Berger to be genuine, even if she is wrong. I mean, I think she's very, very wrong, but I always contemplate, well, maybe she's wrong, but she believes what she's saying. I know I'm getting hammered on Twitter for suggesting that, but that's what I have to do in the absence of these people. Tommy Sheridan is our guest. Patrick says, I think Tommy is spot on with his assessment of Lucianna Berger and her ilk. A lot of comment on this on Twitter. And if we leave Berger...
Richie, the point I have to make to you, mate, I'm sorry to interrupt you.
No, go ahead.
The point I'm having to make is I actually don't agree with you when you say that you have to make these points for balance. Because, you see, you and I don't get the chance to make these points on the BBC.
No, but we have to be better. We have to be better.
Or on ITV, when people like Lucianna Berger get away with telling lies about people like Jeremy Corbyn. Yeah. We don't get the chance to balance it. People want a so-called balance, and there is no such thing as balance. There's a biased media in this country, which is totally and utterly for the neoliberal agenda.
But don't we have to be better, Tommy? Listen, what you said is true. I mean, I could write books about the BBC and RTE, but we have to be better than that, don't we? I mean, they're diabolical, but in the absence of these people, you see, you're not here for 5 minutes and then you get a kick in the arse and you're sent on your way. You're on a show where you can stay as long as you want. So it's incumbent upon us to put these points of view, even if we don't agree with them, because we're better than the BBC, right?
You're a broadcaster of repute, and therefore you believe in balance, and you always try and look at the other point of view. My point is that there are far too few broadcasters like you, like me, who actually put a different narrative, a different agenda, a different perspective. And see, when we're doing that, Richie, I don't think it's beholden upon us to be balanced, because what we're trying to do is even out the unbalance that exists.
Yeah.
So we don't do that by making ourselves more balanced, because that just doesn't change the narrative.
And you're right, the coverage of the claims against the Labour Party by the UK media in totality, the coverage was absolutely disgraceful and one-sided. It was disgusting, wasn't it? To see Jeremy Corbyn sitting down with Andrew Neil, and Neil, he probably rehearsed his interruptions and his comments all day long, badgering and bullying and then refusing to give Jeremy Corbyn a chance to answer the questions. It's garbage dressed up as journalism. I agree with you 100%. Are we moving to a place then, are you worried, where it'll become next to impossible to criticise the state of Israel?
Not at all, because people like me, and I'm sure hundreds of thousands, millions of people across the world who see every single day the Israeli state continuing to build more and more settlements, continuing to occupy illegally more and more land that belongs to the Palestinian state, continuing to ignore international law after international law, we will continue to condemn their war crimes, killing innocent, unarmed children on a daily basis. We will never be silenced, because not that we are anti-Semite, but we are human beings. We've got a heart, Richie, and we've got emotions that show us that we should show compassion to the Palestinian people. The Jewish left, the Jewish socialists are standing up for the Palestinian people. We've got a right to stand shoulder to shoulder with them. We will never be silenced. The Labour Party, that Mr. Starmer, establishment lackey that he is establishing a party that will never, never win the allegiance of real working class socialists, because it's too frightened to stand up against the powerful.
Is it basically back to 1997 again with Keir Starmer? It looks like it.
Of course it is, Richie. I mean, who is the puppet master behind the scenes in all of this?
Yeah.
Mr. Tony Blair's got his hands, his red blood war crime hands, dripping with the blood of innocent Iraqis. He's got his hands all over what's been going on here behind the scenes. And this won't stop, by the way. Starmer is out for blood to get a pure Labour Party that is nothing more than the Tory party map to what it was under Blair. It is a disgrace, Richie. In Scotland, I've got to say, mate, the Labour Party's already an irrelevance. But in England, it's going to become an irrelevance as well.
You might be looking at two or three more Conservative governments, maybe, and what that will mean, of course, for people living on the margins.
There is a challenge here, mate. There's a challenge here tonight. I'm looking on social media and I'm seeing some Labour MPs. I think there's an NEC meeting tonight at 6 o'clock. It may be starting in 15 minutes. That NEC meeting is going to have some people with a bit of backbone. People like John McDonnell. People like Richard Burgess. People like Jeremy. They've got to make up their minds here. People like Len McCluskey. They have got to be honest now. The Labour Party is no longer a party of change. It's no longer the crusade for socialism that it once was supposed to be. They've got to now stand up and form something based on the trade unions, based on socialist ideas, based on the ability to criticise injustice and illegality when it faces them. That means being able to criticise Israel when they continually break international law.
Or anybody else. In the last 5 minutes that we have, you and I had a good ding-dong back in March or April when the lockdown happened. And, I mean, I had great respect for your point of view at the time, because I know you're a humanitarian and you wanted to see the best for people and you wanted to see people protected. And I don't want to rake over those coals. I've never been a supporter of the lockdown, but I've also never been... I hate this kind of thing. Well, if you don't agree with the lockdown, you know, you're happy for old people to die. Not at all. And I've had great doctors on here explaining, you know, how it needn't have happened. Did the Labour Party miss an open goal with respect to, I mean, again, a party that's supposed to be there for the worker, for the working man, for the working woman? I hear loud and clear when you said the government is not doing enough for the lowest paid workers in the country. I hear it and I understand where you're coming from. But the flip side of that argument is Labour could have said, listen, these not only draconian lockdowns, but these real attacks on civil liberties that the Tories have been, you know, rolling out day in, day out now for months. These things are not good. They hit the worst off in society.
Richie, I don't think there's been constructive criticism, mate. I don't think there's been constructive opposition. You and I can disagree about how to deal with the COVID-19 virus. Hopefully, some people, you know, who deny there is a virus, some deny that it even exists. Some people say it's nothing more than a con, and you read all the time that your man in America, Bill Gates, is behind it all. And I've got problems with that, mate, because when I think of the idea that it's all a con, I think to myself, well, actually, I'm quite a big supporter of Cuba. I think the Cuban government and the Cuban people are brilliant. I respect them and I support them. I quite support Maduro in Venezuela. I believe they're trying to tackle poverty and inequality. Yeah. I supported Morales in Bolivia, and I'm over the moon that the Bolivian people have re-elected the Movement for Socialism President Acre rather than allow an American coup to take place. But I don't accept that any of those governments would have got involved in a world con about COVID. It's not a con, it's a reality. Now, are we dealing with it the best way? Yeah, there's a rational debate to be had about that.
Yeah.
But the one thing you've got to say about Starmer and the Labour Party, how dare they not say loud and clear that if any worker is going to lose a job because the government's closing the pub, the restaurant, the supply chain, or any other business, every worker who's getting thrown out a job because of that should be financially compensated.
Absolutely.
And the idea that we go from 80% to 66%, it's 66% of a minimum wage, it's already not enough to live on. How can you live on it if it's 66% of it? It is pathetic, Richie. When are we going to go into the bloody Amazons of the world and the Boots of the world and all the big companies and get them to pay their taxes? When are we going to stop spending £8 billion a year on Trident? Give that money to compensate workers instead of saying that we can't afford to compensate them. That's where the Labour Party should be standing up and fighting. Yes, they should maybe be saying we want more of the evidence to back up the type of lockdowns that are taking place, absolutely. But they have to say that they will not see a single worker sacked because of a government instruction and then just stand idly by.
And just leave them there. Terrible. Final question on that. Listen, you know, I've heard from the there is no virus brigade, and I don't agree with that either. I'm certain that we've had a pretty nasty respiratory virus in the country. I have no doubt about that. I had an Irish biochemist on the programme last night, and he was talking about the World Economic Forum and its stated aim for a kind of a global reset and for a fourth industrial revolution. There is an opinion out there, and I've heard it on this programme from some very credible academics with letters after their name, if that makes them credible, I don't know. And they say, Richie, we think that the virus has been seized upon by people, whether it be the World Economic Forum, whether it be corporations, bankers, who have long wanted, long desired to change the way we live and kind of usher in a more authoritarian way of living. I'm prepared to buy that, Tommy, not because I want to buy it, but because I'm witnessing it, you know, telling us that in the near future we'll have to have a health passport to allow us to move around, that we might have to have 2 or 3 vaccines a year, or we can't go here or we can't go there. I have a bit of sympathy with those who think the virus has been seized upon by people who have long wanted to be in much, much closer control of what we do. Final word to you on that question, and thanks for coming back today, buddy. Love speaking to you. Go ahead, Tommy.
Richie, final word on it, pal. I thoroughly enjoy our discussions and our friendly, constructive debates. Just because we don't always agree with each other doesn't mean we're no friends. We've always got to remember the Marxist approach to debate. You get the thesis, you get the antithesis, and then you get the actual development and progress. And that's what it's all about. I remain to be convinced of this idea of a world approach, because I don't think there's a world government. I think we've got a very, very deeply divided world. We've got some countries in the world who want to pursue a socialist agenda, a redistribution of wealth agenda, a proper health agenda, and I would put Cuba, I would put Venezuela, I would put Bolivia, I'd put those countries into that quarter. However, There are other countries who don't care about any of that. You've got your Brazils, you've got your Hungaries, you've got your Americas, and they're deeply divided. So that's how I don't think there's a world approach to the virus and the pandemic. I think some countries like New Zealand, for instance, have dealt with it much better than any other countries. And New Zealand, in my opinion, has bucked the trend with the neoliberal agenda, elected a government that's not a neoliberal government, a government that is, I would argue, soft left, and is welcome. And that, to me, shows that there are different approaches that can work, don't just impose on people's civil liberties, but actually try and tackle the virus. So that's the way I would look at it, pal. But any time, Richie, that you're looking for a guest, mate, you know I'm available.
Brilliant. And I do see it a bit differently than you, but I am a man of my word. That was the last word on that subject today. Thanks, Tommy. Thanks for coming back, mate. You look
Take
after
care,
yourself.
Fella. Take care.
And speak All soon. Tommy Sheridan, live on the line from his home in Glasgow there. Yeah. A lot of tweets on that. If you want to see what people were tweeting me, search Twitter. Just put Richie Allen Show, all one word. I don't care if you don't like what Tommy Sheridan said. I don't care. I disagree with him, and I've explained it in the monologue today and in every other feckin' monologue. We will always make room for intelligent men and women who have opinions that differ to ours, especially when they hold them sincerely. All righty. It's exactly 8 minutes to the top of the hour. I'm looking forward to speaking in hour two with Leah Butler-Smith, who is a psychotherapist, would you believe? What a time to be in psychotherapy. KeepBritainFree.com. First came across Leah back in the summer. I think I stand to be corrected now, but I think she appeared on This Morning, which is presented by Holly Willoughby and Philip Schofield ordinarily. And she went on there to talk about why she wouldn't wear a mask. And she was also involved in protests in London, which involved people like James Dellingpole, who was on this programme, of course, as you well know, and others. And she is very interesting. So she'll be on with me in hour two. It is Thursday's programme. It is the one and only Richie Allen Show, live from Salford here in the Northwest. It is absolutely bucketing down. It couldn't be any worse, the weather. So, keep those tweets coming in. Do, if you've got any questions you want to, me, I'm thinking of something else when I'm talking to you. If there are any points you want to make to Leah Butler-Smith, do tweet them. Simon Dolan was in court again today, and I am reading or hearing this afternoon that while that was going on, his Twitter account was suspended. Was that on the order of the judge? Did the judge want to prevent people in attendance from tweeting while it was going on? Now, when I say in attendance, it's all done now via Zoom. It's all done remotely. I don't know. We'll try and find out, or I'll try and find out. There isn't any we here. I'll try and find out for you as best as I can. Right, okay. Okay, let's do this then. Back in exactly 60 seconds' time, the Richie Allen Radio Show live on Fab Radio 2, triggerwarning.tv and richieallen.co.uk.
Renowned healer Mark Bajerski travels the world to find the most unique and powerful crystals for self-healing. Since the ancient times, crystals have been used as healing tools. They hold a natural healing vibration and are highly charged in positive energy. Mark teaches how to channel the universal energy and transfer it to the crystal to activate its healing power. Each crystal is used for its unique ability to target a different physical or emotional challenge. Mark Bajerski is an author, healer, speaker, and founder of the Pure Energy Healing Academy. He shares powerful messages of inspiration and healing on his daily YouTube videos, reaching millions worldwide. Mark's crystals, healing oils, and incense sticks are most sought after by other healers. His collection is available online at www.markbajerski.com. His work is presented through Lemon House, a company that creates and curates consciously made gifts.
The Richie Allen Show is live and interactive. All episodes are archived on Podomatic, Spotify, iTunes, and YouTube. For more details, go to richieallen.co.uk.
And 4 minutes to the top of the hour, my great friend Phil Restino in Florida turned 60 years old yesterday. Happy birthday, Phil. Belated happy birthday. Thanks for the email and for the advice. Unsolicited advice, but I don't mind. I'm happy to be advised by you, Phil. Happy birthday, mate. Happy birthday. Right, we've got a tune. Here's a tune from Macy Gray, Leah Butler-Smith in the second hour. The last live radio show of the week. I'll tell you why in a minute. I'm not going to be with you tomorrow. I'll tell you why in a minute. That is Macy Gray, and the song is called I Try. And I think I was working at WLRFM when that was a big hit. So I'm thinking, 99, I'm thinking, wow. Time does fly when the world is mad. Macy Gray there. Going to go to FSN for headlines. When I come back, read some of your comments, then Leah Butler-Smith, Smith even. And I've got some really interesting guests coming up for you next week as well, including Dr. Thomas Binder, a renowned cardiologist based in Baden in Switzerland, who is very vocal in terms of the COVID-19 measures and why they are unnecessary and where it's all leading. He's agreed to come on the programme next week. There are others as well like him, so I'll tell you more about that a bit later on. FSN then, headlines on, it's exactly 6 o'clock. Or shortly after 6 o'clock here in Salford.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Simon Marks. At least 3 people have died after a knife attack in the southern French city of Nice. Britain's opposition Labour Party has suspended its former leader Jeremy Corbyn after a damning report on anti-Semitism within the party during his leadership. And the US economy grew at its fastest rate ever in the third quarter as the country continues to reopen after months of lockdowns.
Yes, those are the headlines. They are the headlines, yes. Let's get rid of the bed. The headlines. Number of you said, Richie, you've not had much to say on what happened in France. I can't. There isn't anything I can say. What can I possibly say about it? It's a dreadful story. It's a dreadful story. You heard it there. 3 people killed in a knife attack in Nice. Allegedly an Islamist terrorist attack. I'm not using the word allegedly in a weaponized way. I haven't a clue what's gone on there. Apparently, one very elderly gentleman was virtually beheaded. This happened in a Catholic church, didn't it? Is that what they're saying? At a church in Nice, a Catholic church. And a male suspect was shot and detained very shortly afterwards. A guy called Brahim Awasawi, 21 years of age, from Tunisia. He arrived in Italy in September and ended up in France, came to France earlier this month. Other than that, I have nothing to say about that. I certainly have no opinion of it, because I don't know what's going on, to be honest, at the best of times. I'm sure the... I'm not going to go there. 2 other stories I've been following today. Excuse my voice, it's a bit hoarse. I'm a little hoarse today. I'm a Shetland pony. I'm a little hoarse. Little hoarse. 2 stories. One is that Spotify, which is a music streaming platform and podcast streaming platform, which is enormous, enormous. I subscribe to it, I must admit, I do. And even though I don't use it very much, come to think of it, I'm into the vinyl, you see. I don't use Spotify so much, but it is coming under pressure, is Spotify, to get rid of somebody called Joe Rogan. Do you know who Joe Rogan is? I do, but I don't have much time to listen to him. I'm reliably informed that he has a very good podcast, video podcast thing, with a huge following around the world. He's a martial artist turned podcast host, is this guy Rogan. And he recently hosted Alex Jones, my old pal, on his program, which is called The Joe Rogan Show. And on that show, they talked about COVID-19 and they talked about vaccines and how vaccines sometimes make people sick. And apparently, Rogan did a fairly decent job of keeping it, you know, at least making sure that all sides were heard. But some people didn't like it and they are calling upon Spotify now to dump or drop the Joe Rogan Show. This is where we are, of course. We don't like something that we've heard. What do we do? Do we debate it? Do we invite Joe Rogan and Alex Jones onto another show with a big audience and challenge them? No, we don't. We demand that they are banned, banished, cancelled. This is where we are. And also today, the BBC laid out plans to prevent its staff from expressing political opinions and such like on social media. Gary Lineker, former football player, host of Match of the Day, is well known for expressing his opinions on current affairs, politics, local and national and geopolitical, and that has drawn criticism from some of his fellow BBC sports presenters, including Jonathan Agnew, who's a very well-known cricket correspondent, cricket commentator. So the BBC is going to take this on and is laying out rules and regulations for its own staff, which will prevent them from giving their opinion online. Basically, the BBC will say, if you work for the BBC, you are breaching our rules around impartiality by expressing your opinion. Now, I know it's laughable. It's almost belly laughable. The BBC has never been impartial, at least not in my lifetime. Anyway, but there you go. It's also going to put pressure on its own staff to be more upfront about other commercial activities. So if you work for the BBC in news or in entertainment, your salary, at least the salary paid by the BBC, is a matter of public record. But lots of BBC people, they do other things for other people. Commercial interests. The BBC wants them to be upfront about those things as well. All right. Fair enough. A couple of interesting stories I found interesting today. Let's get my next guest on the programme then. These are strange old times. She is a psychotherapist and an activist. She has been described in the media as being an anti-mask activist. I don't think that's very fair. It's a very, very simplistic way of describing her. But I follow her on Twitter and she's very interesting and very funny at times as well. And she took part in protests in the summer. She spoke at events where people like James Dellingpole, who was on this programme, where James was speaking. She was on this morning, of course, on ITV, talking about her refusal to wear a mask at the time when mask wearing was introduced. A lot going on. Let's welcome to the programme Leah Butler-Smith. Leah, welcome to the programme. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
Hey, I tell you what a time to be a psychotherapist, eh?
What a time.
And you know, it's funny, and there are lots of funny avenues we could go down, and there are lots of gags we could make. But I have noticed in the press and listened to the national and local radio news programmes lately, Leah, people are attempting suicide. People are locking themselves away. People are becoming withdrawn. People are becoming sick to the point where they're being medicated by their doctors. Is that even being understated, do you think, by the media? How serious do you think that might become?
It's massively serious, and it's not even just being underplayed. It's not being discussed at all, actually. They're just not talking about it. They're staying away from it. And if you just look at the London Ambulance tweet, you probably saw that. That's their way, I believe, of trying to get the information out about how serious the increase in suicides and suicide attempts actually is at the moment. Because in London, it's 15 a day more than normal. And it's been rising in the last few years anyway. So it was already a problem. But to have another 15 a day is absolutely astonishing. And that's just in London. So if you take that across the whole country, that's, you know, going to be many, many more deaths and, you know, attempted deaths. It's just horrific. It's absolutely horrific. And they don't care and they don't want to talk about it. They don't normally publish their suicide data until sort of the next year. And that's why I think it's quite interesting that it was London Ambulance that decided to tweet that fact, because, again, you know, they're the NHS. They're not allowed to talk about anything. So it's their way of just letting us all know just how serious this really is. And from the people that I've spoken to, like when I've spoken to the police, they've let me know that they want us, the people, to contact our MPs because they're paralysed. They're not allowed to speak out. They're not allowed to do anything about what they're told to do. But from the mental health crisis, I've been told, and I don't have any links, unfortunately. People always say to me, where's the links to this? Well, quite often you can't get a link to that kind of information. because it isn't anywhere. It won't exist. But consultants were talking about the number of people with psychosis in the mental health units in hospitals exceeded the number of COVID patients in ICU during the peak of infection. And that's incredible, again, because psychosis is a really devastating illness. And they were talking about that happening to people with no prior mental health problems at all. So, and you know, we can talk about phobias if you want. Are you still there?
I'm absolutely gripped by this. Of course I'm still here. You're an expert. I'm just letting you get on with it. This is really important.
Okay. Well, I mean, I actually talked to a group of psychologists that this is one of the things that I hope people will be pleased to hear is when we were sort of floundering around individually, you know, and I threw out that tweet in the middle of July when they started talking about doing, well, forcing masks in shops. And it was the tipping point for me. And I just had this moment of rantiness, which you're probably quite familiar with as well.
Yeah.
Not we talk to each other over Twitter. But yeah, that's where I sort of let off steam sometimes. And I had this moment of despair and I said, right, that's it. We're going to march on Whitehall. And by the next day, so I did that sort of late in the evening. And the next morning I woke up and I was like, oh my God, people have really reacted to this. It's kind of gone viral. And that's when Simon and Dolan was saying, right, okay, what do you need? Let's get you sorted.
Yeah.
I was like, oh no, I've actually got to do it now. And I did. But we only had a few hundred people because at the time, obviously, no one had done anything, a sort of a planned event, an advertised event, if you like. There was a Facebook group, Stand Up X people had been doing something before. And then Louise May Creffield of Save Our Rights had previously been doing her own thing down in Brighton. But there wasn't really anything that had garnered any media attention. And of course, that's why they just wanted to label me something not very nice.
Yeah.
Call me an anti-masker. But really, I just was incensed. I was incensed that Cressida Dick had said it was perfectly acceptable to shame people who were suffering from hidden disabilities. And, you know, I just couldn't believe that that's the kind of thing that was going on. So that was where I met James in the flesh and Dellingpole and a number of other people who turned up, but some of them actually turned up during the day and they started to talk about the fact that they also did not know there was any resistance to what was going on, that they don't do social media. So they weren't aware of all these Facebook groups. They weren't aware that there were people on Twitter who were, you know, horrified at what was happening. And so they'd said, you know, thank goodness Sky News actually did an interview with Claire Wills Harrison, who spoke at the event, and she's a lawyer acting for the elderly who's yeah. been screaming from the rooftops about the devastating harms that they've suffered and also the genocide that's been going on inside care homes. And there are police involved in some of these cases now. But if she hadn't been doing what she was doing, I don't know how far that would have gotten. We know that Amnesty have now decided to actually publish their report. Where's that gone? And how come all of the brainwashed people in the country don't know that their actions, their acquiescence, and this is where I do get very frustrated, and it's not my therapist head that's talking. This is I'm insanely angry that people aren't aware or choosing not to be aware of what their acquiescence is doing to those elderly people. So Save Grandma, no, sorry, you've just allowed the government to kill Grandma by not doing anything to question what's going on and just, you know, sticking your head in the sand, really, and hoping it's all going to go away, which we know it will not. And the other things that are damaging to mental health, I mean, the neurological damage, the brain damage that's going on, people don't seem to realise that if you don't have, they class it as acute symptoms. If you have dizziness, if you have headaches, if you have any of those sorts of symptoms or some problems with your concentration, having worn a mask for any period of time, that's what you call an acute reaction to lack of oxygen to the brain. But if it becomes chronic, so you're being asked to wear that mask every single day, which we know frontline workers NHS workers, all of them now have to wear them all day, and they weren't having to wear them, not even in the peak of infection. They weren't wearing them at all. And so, you know, those people, unfortunately, are going to be suffering from chronic lack of oxygen. And you do get these, well, they're a combination of people who aren't very intelligent, so they don't do any research on their own. They've heard someone else say it on social media, so they're just going to be a parrot and repeat it. Or they're trolls or 77th. So you get that combo of people who say, what about the surgeons? You know, they all wear masks all the time.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're not having any problems. Well, actually, I talk to health workers, and I can tell you now, whatever their profession is, they are sick to the back teeth of having to wear a mask all day, and they are suffering those acute symptoms. But when they stop suffering the symptoms, that means their body has now acclimatized to it, and we're dealing with chronic oxygen deprivation. And why surgeons don't have that is because they pump tons and tons and tons of oxygen into the surgeon, the environment that they're working in. They have breaks regularly as well. And actually, they don't even have to wear masks because it's been proven that it never did stop the transmission of any kind of droplet infections anyway.
You're right. It's Vernon Coleman said to me, it's really to prevent a little bit of moustache or a little bit or a little bit of apple or a bit of peanut from your tooth falling into an open wound. And he was right to say that. Leah Butler-Smith is our guest. She's a psychotherapist and an activist. Listen, I've got to ask you this, and I'm genuinely curious. I'm the last to know everything. When you say 77th, what do you mean by that?
Oh, the 77th Brigade. That is the lovely Tobias. I've forgotten his surname.
Elwood.
Tobias.
Elwood, is it?
Yes. It's his brigade. So their army. I believe there's another. Someone, I think, mentioned the 33rd, but I didn't know if they were joking at the time. I thought, oh, no, they're bringing more into bully us. But they are actually paid to stop misinformation on social media. And obviously, as they're orders are coming down from the government, that the what they consider to be misinformation is us lot. Anything that anyone says basically that questions what the government are doing is going to be considered guilty of misinformation. So I'm constantly being banned. I'm shadow banned on Twitter. I've been banned again for 7 days on Facebook. And the funny thing about that is, well, you know me, Richie, I do get a bit cross and angry, and I might say nasty things sometimes, yeah. Even though I am a jolly good therapist. And when I'm working with my clients, I'm as lovely as can be. And I'm a nice mummy and a nice grandma. Actually, I'm not a grandma. Don't call me that. I'm a Mimi. That's what I am. I have that lovely personality, but equally, I can get really cross. And there was this scientist who was on talk radio putting down all of the Great Barrington Declaration scientists and, you know, just suggesting that they were nobodies and all of their peers thought they were talking rubbish. And so I wrote a post about her probably maybe 10 days ago. And I think I might have called a bit of a weasel witch or something along those lines, because I thought she was just a dreadful being. And that's what I got banned for today. So that interests me, because Simon Dolan, whose case is today, has also been banned off Twitter and without any reason at all.
Now, that's a good. Let's go there. I've got in front of me a brilliant article in today's Times by Michael Gardner, who's acting for Simon in Simon's Judicial Review, which we've discussed on the programme with Simon several times. And he's written a fantastic opinion piece in today's Times about that. And today began the latest, round, I shouldn't say round of hearing, but the latest chapter in that judicial review. I know it's been done remotely. I wonder, was Simon's Twitter account briefly suspended on an order, by the judge, because the judge didn't want anybody tweeting or commenting while it was in session? What do you think?
Well, I suppose we could be kind and suggest that might have been the case. I don't believe it's what Simon thinks has happened. I think he's much more under the impression that he's just been silenced.
Yeah, and that might be the case. Hey, listen, that might very well be the case. It's happened many times before. I know it has. But I'm just wondering. I'd like to get to the bottom of that. But just again, for our listeners who might not be aware of what's going on, Simon Dolan is a very well-known businessman. And Simon and others are fighting in court against the lockdown restrictions. And they've, we're talking about two sets of judicial review proceedings here. And again, if you can get to the Times, I know the Times isn't free online, but it's a very good article by Mark Gardner, because he explains brilliantly how Parliament, or how the government, has managed to do what the government has managed to do using that 1984 Act and provisions contained within, buried within the 1984 legislation, which gives the government the ability to make laws without any scrutiny or any approval from Parliament whatsoever. And that's spooky. And that, well, it's beyond spooky. It's Orwellian, and that's what Simon Dolan is taking on. He's a top man, isn't he? to carry on. I mean, he must be heartbroken that business in general hasn't got his back, to use that phrase. They haven't supported him, so they haven't.
No, and, you know, I've got to know him because of what's going on. But as it turns out, we're both Chelmsfordians. You know, that's where we've both grown up. So he moved on and out of the town, but has lots of memories. And so when we've met face to face and had some drinks and got to know each other a bit better, he, you know, we were talking about the market and sharing some memories and things like that. So I've come to know him personally, and I absolutely adore the man. I have the most respect for him. I'm aware that he did sort of sit there and just go, what the hell, like many of us did. And some of us were a lot more down the rabbit hole. And I don't mean that in the conspiracy side of things. I just mean we'd kind of started really deeply looking. And I certainly was back in February. And that was because I was just about to have, well, I wasn't having, my daughter was giving birth to my second grandbaby in March. And I wanted to know that this thing that was being talked about in the media wasn't going to be what they were suggesting it was. And so I'd started looking into it because part of my work, I'm actually a clinical hypnotherapist and I'm an NLP trainer. And the reason why I mention those two things is because part of that work is about help having an understanding of what drives behaviors. So how do we construct our version of the world? And, you know, why do we think the way we do? And why do we behave the way we do? And why do we react the way we do? But also it's, I teach people, I have taught people in groups with the NLP trainer side of things, how to become better salespeople, how to use language positively, and so on and so on. So I had a better understanding perhaps of what I was starting to see happening through the media than most people. I mean, I found it and have continued to find it incredibly alarming that they are using this fear to condition people. And obviously we've looked at the SAGE documentation and seen they're black and white. You know, they're going to use fear to coerce the public, and it's a very well known manipulation. And that's why we now have people who actually are frightened of people. I said that to James Denningpole. They're not fearful of germs, it's actually a fear of people that they're developing. And so that's pretty serious stuff. But I know I sort of went off on the track there.
Okay, no, you didn't. This is brilliant. This is brilliant. Hang on, let's stay with that. We'll talk about what you told James Denningpole in a moment about people fearing people. This is fantastic. There is a study out today. Don't ask me who published it. It isn't one of the universities, but I think it's a study published by a group of psychologists, and it's about arguments, rows, and basic, you know, falling outs that are happening between people over this. We'll come back to that. I want to stay with February because we've got Leah Butler-Smith on the program. She's a clinical hypnotherapist, a psychotherapist, and is trained in understanding and teaching neuro-linguistic programming, NLP. What you said there, let's stay with this. In February, you were basically able to deconstruct what they were doing because of your own training and understanding. That must have been fascinating back then.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't really want to believe that there was any real manipulation of the public. It was, at the time, I was observing what was being said, in a, you know, alarmed at what the media were doing and concerned for why they would want to make people so frightened when really the government should be instructing them to try and keep everybody calm. And, you know, that's good for your immune system, is if you're calm, but the more stressed you are, the less effective your immune system. So it kind of didn't make sense even from that point of view, because what I was sort of mentioning there as well is I've been a health researcher for over two decades. So I know how to look into, you know, studies, and I'm not a scientist and I'm not a physician. I'm not medically trained, but I've done enough research to really learn and have an understanding of how to look at one of those medical studies and sort of get the bits out of it that make sense. So I'd started to look at what viruses were. I wanted to understand what was coming out of China. But, you know, you're sort of watching these bits of media where this person falls and then puts their hands out. And I'm sorry, but you've got to be a bit stupid not to know that if somebody's falling and they're unconscious because, you know, that's it, they've fainted, they don't put their hands out.
No.
That was really farcical, and that was one of the first things I noted. But also just the fact that it was China who seemed to be leading a lot of what we were taking on board as advice. And I thought, well, that was very strange, just as an observer of the world and the world we live in as Westerners compared to what our normal opinion of China had been. And then I started to look at what was happening in Italy. And I had someone, a friend who lived in Italy, who was over dramatizing. So I started to watch the way that people were being manipulated and how that then rippled out to their behavior on social media. And you probably know, Richie, if we did not have social media, we would not be in this mess. So they've literally used social media as a weapon and a tool to manipulate the masses and have them pitted against each other. So it was that, so, you know, China aren't allowed. They're not allowed. There's a firewall or whatever you call it. They're not allowed to talk to people on Facebook. They're not allowed to, you know, get leaked documents out and do all sorts of things. So anything that started to happen like that, you start to look at it with one eye slightly closed, you know, oh, not sure about that. And then when Italy were having this big overreaction, but equally, because I'm incredibly curious, I was looking at what the Italian doctors were saying. I did need some of those things to be translated, but there was a doctor being quite vocal about the fact that there was this correlation between the two areas in the north there that had regular overwhelms and lots of heavy criticism in their media every single year for not being able to take care of the elderly when they had their flu season. And then Milan, which has got 5 million people, which is very, very close to these two areas, wasn't suffering the same number of deaths. So he was looking at, well, what's, you know, that's what your detective, your Columbo is going to do.
Yeah.
They're going to go, what is the difference? So what he was able to sort of see very quickly was that there'd been this new high strength flu vaccine that had been given to all of the elderly. They'd actively encouraged them because these two regions did have these horrible problems every year with their health service, that seemed to be a way to prevent that from happening. But they'd also actively encouraged them all to have the meningococcal vaccine as well. So that meant these elderly people in those two areas had had a double strength flu vaccine, and on top of that, a meningococcal vaccine, which just a little bit of common sense. You don't have to understand what a vaccine is, but we know it's designed to aggravate the immune system. So the immune system goes, what are you? You're not me. Sod off. And that's what it's supposed to do.
And you're dealing with people.
That.
Yeah, and you're dealing with, if this is true, and I mean, you're saying it is, and I know I have seen some of this, so I'm inclined to believe that you know what you're talking about. And I know the information is online. If you're right, then you're dealing with people with probably, in many cases, very seriously compromised immune systems anyway. And these vaccines would have been, well, could have been, and maybe were very problematic in many cases. I wonder, is that in any way related to news that we've seen coming out of Korea and out of Singapore in the last few days, where 50 people at least have died after having a flu vaccine? And I can't for the life of me get the numbers, not the numbers, but get the real data. Like, what were the age groups of these people in Korea who died suddenly after having a flu vaccine? I don't know this to be true, but I would hazard the guess that those people might have been in their senior years, Leah.
Mm.
Maybe.
Yeah. And that's the other thing that the doctor said as well, coming out of Italy, is that it was the very elderly and those with comorbidities who were suffering, which, of course, we heard across the board for all COVID deaths anyway. And we know that absolutely to be true now. But what he was suggesting was there was a risk of the vaccine viral interference side of things as well, which is another known phenomena. It's not unknown. There are studies and reports, and it's, you know, if you look down the PubMed, you'll find lots and lots of references to those sorts of concerns. So when someone then, even if they didn't actually like, we, that is that concern, as you've just described, that there's an immediate reaction, there's an immediate death happening. And I have to say, I know this is pure speculation. It cannot be. I haven't substantiated and I haven't chased it, but I have seen a number of comments on social media where people are talking about the fact that in a care homes there are people dying soon after having their flu vaccine, which would correlate with what we're seeing coming out of Korea. But I'm going to lay that to one side because I haven't substantiated it, so I don't know. But what the Italian chap was saying is that there was a concern also about this viral vaccine induced interference, which means they've had the vaccines, that has done what it did to their immune system. It's made it less effective, if you like. It's more vulnerable, and that is, again, a known, it's reported in the studies, side effect of the flu vaccine, which is, it kind of makes you step back and go, so why, sorry, why are we, why would we give that to anybody really, if you're going to make them more vulnerable to then getting any other sort of virus and just not being terribly well. In fact, there's the, one of the studies shows, in fact, it was the British Medical Journal, obviously highly respected, that there was a 36% increase in children suffering all sorts of other illnesses, not just viruses, because they'd had the flu vaccine. That's been presented in to the government. The government know these things. They're not stupid. And the government advisors know these things. So the fact that they had this massive campaign and have this massive campaign to get every elderly person vaccinated for flu this year, knowing that the British Medical Journal had then subsequently come out and written another study, and actually they've got kind of conversations. It's not necessarily a study per se. It's more all of them going, look at this, and look at this, and look at this. There's a real concern that the flu vaccine is going to make people more susceptible to COVID for all of the reasons that I've just talked about. So if they're talking about it and the government are doing nothing but actually pushing, you just, again, I just step back and go, what's
why?
That about then?
Why? Why would they do it? And we learned in the last 48 hours, number of sources claiming that a coronavirus vaccine of sorts will be available this side of Christmas and will be recommended very strongly for the most vulnerable. So we might have a situation, and I know nothing about medicine, so I'm not saying what will or what won't happen because I don't know. But we these are legitimate concerns you're expressing. So you might have a situation where senior people who've got compromised immune systems are getting a flu vaccine, and on top of that are getting a coronavirus vaccine that's been rushed into being. That spells danger for me. And again, I'm going to qualify that by saying I don't know anything about these things, but I can cite precedents. I should say. We know that these things have been problematic in the past. Imagine that. So here's a flu vaccine, and maybe a day or two later, maybe at the same time, maybe 3 weeks later, here's the coronavirus vaccine. You're saying that you, as somebody who brushes up against health workers and NHS workers, you're a clinical hypnotherapist, a psychotherapist, you'd be very concerned about the outcome of that.
Just, that's purely from my own research. Yeah. None of the experts that I've spoken to, none of the health professionals that I've spoken to have any other information, because they're not vaccinologists. One of the people I've spoken to is, and yes, she does have serious concerns. But actually, the majority of them are, I talk to psychologists, I talk to various other staff who work, you know, they're my clients, you know, so I work with them and try to help them manage their stress. A lot of them have really struggled with what's been going on. And I've also done some interviews for Simon's Keep Britain Free. So I've interviewed a nurse who's a bit of a whistleblower, I suppose, but she's not currently working for the NHS, but has done for a very long time. And that conversation was amazing because she's like me. She does a lot of health research for her work. It kind of supports her work, but it's not what she's paid to do per se. And it just then makes you that much more curious, that much more open-minded, and you're, again, because she's a mum, she wanted to understand what was happening with this virus. And she'd been through the H1N1 episode, which she said was so much worse because they were losing young people. Now, they had lower numbers, but we don't really know what's going on with the numbers because they've been messed about so much, with the flu deaths suddenly vanishing. And then you've got more, you know, so we know that a lot of the COVID deaths were not COVID deaths at all, because Patrick Vallance even admitted that. We know that there have been doctors under the impression that they're supposed to put COVID on death certificates, even if they didn't really have any symptoms of it. And I don't really get how a doctor can be that stupid.
Hey, let me put the government point of view to you, Leah. Leah Butler-Smith is our guest this hour. When challenged about the disappearance of flu, well, not even challenged, they haven't been challenged, but listening to BBC Radio 4 and 5 this morning, when politicians have been on there, they've said that flu seemingly disappeared because we've obviously locked down and we've taken such great care to try and stop the spread of coronavirus. That's actually had a very positive effect on the amount of flu cases. So flu is going away because we're washing our hands, we're wearing face masks, we're social distancing to protect against COVID. That's what they say. What do you say?
Well, that's really intriguing because throughout the summer months, you had this this increase in the flu deaths that were being reported. They were available on the Office of National Statistics website and the ONS, and they were 10 times higher than COVID deaths for about 14 or more weeks. I actually sort of lost count of it because we started to go into the flu season properly around that sort of 14th, 15th week. But that one of my little things that I used to pose as a quandary for those who we still want to believe everything that the government and the media are saying. Not all of the media now, they're slowly moving over to the right side. But one of the things that I wanted people to really start to think about is, having sort of studied what people have said about masks and mask wearing, and I've got, like I said, really serious concerns about what that's doing to children's brains and their other organs, actually, but especially their brains, is that the droplets for COVID are so tiny, tiny, tiny that they can escape through the mask. They're actually much, much smaller than the you know, gaps between the fibres that you can't see with the naked eye. So the COVID is not stopped, no matter what, through with mask wearing. But flu particles, because they're much, much larger, technically you'd think, well, they could be. So if there's all these people dying of flu, 10 times the number of people dying of flu for all of those weeks through the summer, that would suggest that actually none of the measures did anything to stop any infectious disease whatsoever, yeah. Especially not the flu, which clearly is far more infectious and far more deadly. And that was it. You know, there's the evidence, mic drop sort of thing. But yeah. Unfortunately, you know, the government somehow managed to swerve out of that one as well. And I have to say, talking about the government, because I have been speaking to so many different people, and I did start to phone some councillors the other week when I was told that I actually did a midnight rant on Facebook, a live in my pyjamas rant at the councillor in Basildon, which is in my county, who'd announced that we were going to be put into tier two. And I'd discovered, obviously, at this point that there was going to be some money involved, and they all said it's not going to happen, it's not going to happen. And we've subsequently seen the evidence that they did collect their cheque, thank you very much, quite a few million. And so I started to contact the councillors. And what I discovered is what I'd already been told by someone who knows someone, knows someone who's inside the government, that actually, whilst we know, because I'm just going to base what I'm going to say here on what a professional says, and that is the delightful Michael Yeadon, that he, you know, is very much a leader in all of this because he's incredibly passionate. He's got the knowledge. He knows what he's talking about. If you put him up against Patrick Vallance in a room and we could all just watch the word battle, we know who's going to win.
Yeadon worked for GSK, didn't he, for GlaxoSmithKline?
Exactly. Yeah. He's so much more than that. You know, there's so much to that man about understanding communication.
Oh, yeah, that wasn't a criticism. That was more to boost the guy's credibility.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, absolutely. He knows his stuff. And they were peers early on. So he knows Patrick Vallance and he knows his intelligence. He knows that for him to be able to state what he's stating is an out-and-out lie, because you can't say that and be in that profession and be at that level, or even not even be at that level. You can't even have started your training as a scientist and call yourself a scientist who understands that and state the things they're saying about the immune system now. He said anyone who says that is an out-and-out liar. So when he's talking about all of the concerns that he has and the blatant lies that they're sort of spouting, what I've heard, so obviously I can't prove this, but what I've heard is that a lot of the ministers are the same as the councillors that I spoke to, and that is they don't understand the science and they therefore can't argue when someone presents it to them and says it's a fact.
Right.
So that's what they're dealing with, is an authority figure who's very bolshy about it, you know,
Pfizer.
Very confident.
Yeah, it was Pfizer, not GSK. Pfizer, wasn't it, he worked for Yeadon. Maybe he did spend some time at GSK, but yeah, his credentials in that field are unimpeachable, really. And yet, apart from talk radio, I don't think any other media outlet in the country has spoken with him.
No, and it's possibly because, I mean, but isn't it funny when you think if one MP accused another MP in the same way that Michael Yeadon is accusing Patrick Vallance of malfeasance. You know, it's effectively it's the highest. You know, he should be in prison for what he's currently doing. And we don't know, you know, if they kidnap one of his children and threatening to kill them. That's not funny, by the way, but that's just, you know, there's got to be some enormously powerful motivation for him to continue his lie. And it's a horrible thought that it could just be money. We know that Whitty's been offered some position. Well, we don't know. We've been told there is that speculation amongst the freedom community that Chris Whitty's been offered the opportunity of a WHO position, and that's very attractive in the scientific world. Because, you know, that's the thing about scientists, is they're very ego driven, and you get that in some professions. Some professions are more power than ego, but the ego in amongst the scientific community is all about, look at me, look at me, look at what I did, look at how what I've discovered, look at what I found. But they're not averse to the idea of manipulating the data to suit what the person paying their bills wants them to prove. And they've studied it, you know, that's one of the most fascinating studies of all time, is the study of the scientific study of scientific behaviors.
Yeah. I know the rumors about Whitty. We know that Valance is in possession of GSK shares to the tune of £800,000 or thereabouts. It's filthy. We've got Sarah Butler-Smith. If you want to follow, let me get this right. Leah Butler-Smith. Jesus, Leah, I'm looking at a comment from Sarah. I'll read that out in a minute. We've got Leah Butler-Smith on the show. She's a clinical hypnotherapist. She's a psychotherapist and is uniquely qualified, at least as far as the guests I've had on recently, to talk about this. Do follow her on Twitter. It's at Leah Butler-Smith on Twitter. Check her out. There. I want to come back in the time we have left to it must be huge, as frustrating as it must be for you, it must also be incredibly interesting, because there is that that study of human behaviour, how fascinating that is. And you talked earlier on about how Twitter, how social media was weaponized, has been used as a big tool in stoking the fear that we see. I mentioned earlier on there was a group of psychologists speaking on the radio this morning, talking about how arguments between people, but serious arguments in public and in public spaces, that are increasingly tending to spill over into serious aggression that ultimately becomes violent, that this is new. And they're putting it down to this, to people who don't believe what's happening is necessary, and those who are begging for more lockdowns and begging for the vaccine to save us. And you believe, do you? I know you said this earlier on, that social media and Twitter in particular has enabled this to happen.
It's enabled, it's driving a lot of the ideology. I mean, there's an awful lot of this. It's a mass hypnosis. It's actually a mass delusion as well. You know, when you believe something that actually, if you check the facts, is proven to be untrue, but you believe it anyway, then that's about identity. So people have literally, they've adopted the mask wearing as part of their identity.
Yeah.
Didn't take very long for that to happen for some people. And it's about, I'm good, you're bad. I'm safe, you're unsafe. And that whole phobia of human beings is going to be a massive, massive problem. And we are hearing constantly from parents with children, even those parents who are on our side, who are hearing their 2 and 3 year olds expressing fears and anxiety around touching or getting too close to grandma, or because the news might have been on, or they've heard other people talking about it. So, yeah, the reason why people are behaving so extraordinarily badly towards each other is not an unknown phenomenon. You've only got to go back and study the 1930s, 1940s,
yeah,
Second World War. And, you know, literally that was the play-by-play. This is how you do it. And they've just taken their instructions from the propaganda book. It's actually called that, I think, propaganda, that was written. Was it Freud's son, I think, someone fairly invested in understanding psychology, had written that book. And it was taken from that understanding of how they managed to manipulate their entire country and other countries into doing what they wanted them to do. So what they're doing is they've now made So you've got mask wearing as part of your identity, which, as I say, is a label for I'm good and you're therefore bad because you're not wearing. But it's also that I'm safe, you're not safe. So now you're going to threaten my life. And people's reaction, their responses, the reason why it's so heightened and so up there is because they're coming from the part of the brain that doesn't have access to critical thinking. So they've turned off the critical thinking. That's gone off to sleep. It's offline. And now it's the amygdala and it's the other parts of the brain, the primal brain, that's going, right, fight, flight, or freeze. And so I'm just going to fight because you are a danger. So when people jump out of the way, and I've only had it happen once, but I'm aware of others who've said someone's jumped in the road.
Yeah, well, it happened to me. It happened to me. I run every single day of the week. I never take a break. I run from Salford to Manchester and back, and yeah, people have jumped. A guy nearly got killed a few weeks back, jumped off the footpath. Ooh. Even though I was, you know, moving to the extreme other edge, jumped away from it and nearly got hit by a car. Edward Bernays, propaganda is what you're referring to. That's a brilliant point. Number of people have said to me, including my great friend, the oft-mentioned Jean-Anne Crowley, number of people have said, the mask wearers seem or appear to be in a trance to us. They appear to be under hypnosis of sorts. Is that taking it a bit too far? Or do you think, yes, they are a bit trance-like?
They are absolutely. It's called conditioning, you know. So you don't do conditioning in a flash. It's something that happens over a period of time. And just as an example, I test things. If I go into a shop, for example, I find it quite amusing to start talking to somebody about the things I know they believe, and they will be fascinated. And then if I've captured them in the right way, one of the questions they'll ask me quite early on is, and who are you and what do you do? Yeah. And I will lie. And so I'm going to put my hands up here and say I have lied a couple of times to people and said I'm a microbiologist and blah, 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 blah. And I've just broken some of the myths that they've bought into. And I can see their little critical thinking starting to come back online and starting to sort of look for the information. I mean, we could talk about this all day.
So how have they lost their critical thinking? Do people switch it off themselves, or are there environmental factors at play that cause us to lose temporarily our ability to look at things critically and to analyse them for ourselves?
It's actually a little bit to do with brain functionality, and it's how much of the system that we can literally use. So we can only use so much of the system for critical thinking at any given time. So we tend to sort of store things in different compartments, and we generalize loads of things. So, for example, you will know what a door is, even if you've never walked through it before. It's a brand new door, never seen before, but your brain already knows that's a door. It's generalized, that piece of information. So that's how your brain starts to sort and sift bits and pieces. And that gives you less, let's say, it's about the power of the engine and where it's actually focusing. So you don't need to keep using all of that energy and effort moment to moment, day to day, because it's all been parked somewhere else. So what I was doing recently with somebody who I knew is not the sort of personality that would normally toe the line, not the kind of person who would ever have done what he was told at school, but who was nevertheless wearing a mask because his perception was it was going to save his grandma.
Right.
And it was therefore the right thing to do. And he was quite happy to look with disdain at anyone who wasn't prepared to protect his grandma, because that's what he'd heard, and he'd heard it enough. You've only got to hear something three times for it to start to become a thing. Advertisers understand that mentality. So,
and they heard it far more than three times, amazingly.
Yes. And 300. Also with fear. Let's remember that, because if you want to inject, there's certain ways. If anyone wants to read anything that will really help them to understand this, read Robert Cialdini. His books are social science experiments. They've conducted tons and tons of experiments, and they've also researched some of the most horrible things that have ever happened. For example, the mass suicide of a cult, and they wanted to try and understand what it would take how did they get the woman, for example, with the baby, to poison her baby and then kill herself. And she wouldn't do it, actually, at first. Her mother's instinct and her nurturing side said no and resisted, But then another person leapt forward, jumped in, grabbed the cup, started guzzling this poison. And that was all it took for her to then follow. So that's why peers and following what our peers are doing and looking around to see what our peers are doing is often a massive influence. And that's what people are doing at the moment. You will see on a tube, if you get on a tube, this was, again, I know I can bounce around from 17 different topics, so do rein me in whenever you're ready.
No, it's very good. No, it's succinct and it's linear. It's easy to follow this. It's staggering as well, to be honest.
I like to say I'm sort of creating a few nested loops and every now and then I might remember one and come back and close it. But on a tube, actually going into one of the events in London, Trafalgar Square, I sat down and there was a chap sitting next to me, quite a handsome looking man, and he wasn't wearing a mask. And I sort of gazed up and noticed this young girl get on and I watched her face and she looked at him and then she looked at me and then she took her mask off and then she sat down and she was smiling.
Delighted.
And she wasn't smiling at us. She was just sitting there smiling like, oh God, thank God, you know. And she got her lipstick out, she put her lipstick on and she literally sat there smiling for about 10 minutes. So that's what she needed. She needed to see other people that are brave doing the thing that she knew was the right thing for her to do. But you could equally then have someone on a tube, you know, glaring at you as James Dillingpole had recently on a train,
being
massively attacked and vilified for complaining about. And I think didn't someone write something about him in a media publication? But yeah, that's
James
just
was James was brave because he engaged with the guy and then took a photograph of him, which you know, listen, I'm a pretty big boy and I'm not scared of many people, but I wouldn't advise everybody to take that approach. But it must be incredibly unsettling, you know, to be in that situation. And I hear from many listeners on emails I get, tweets I get, they tell me, had it, Richie, I had it the other day, I was confronted. And when people are confronted, Leah, it's a terrible thing for many people to be confronted. It's a very unsettling thing.
You know, I'm actually quite a confident person, and I can tell you that's something that I've developed. That's why I'm in the world I'm in, and it's why I do what I do, because I wasn't the most confident person, and I did have anxiety and panic attacks and depression in my up until my late 20s when I went into training. So it, like a lot of people who go into any field of psychology and personal development, it's usually to save themselves first. So you know they're all a bit screwed up. Well, you hope that they've maybe done enough work of themselves over the way. But yeah, when I went to the supermarket the first time without a mask, having already then publicised or having had my very vocal concerns about masks being vocalised, and of course knowing that the media twisted that so that I would appear to be the worst devil person on the planet who's refusing to wear a mask and going around trying to kill everyone's granny. And so I was very determined that I obviously wasn't going to go back on what I've just made this big stand about. And it would have massively caused me anxiety to put a mask on, because for me, it means something. It means something really devastating. And so I walked in, and this girl on the till sort of waved at me and started calling, excuse me, excuse me, excuse me. So I sort of looked over my shoulder and I thought, right, what's going to happen here? Let's have a see. And I couldn't see where the wave or couldn't see where the voice was coming from. But then she raised her arm again. So by this time, I'd already turned my attention away from her and I just carried on into the shop and then saw two other women also not wearing masks. And I thought, oh, this is better than what I thought. Yeah. So I felt very, very brave. By the end of it, I knew that I could do it again. But then the first time I'd been into my town, and this wasn't necessarily that I was frightened of any confrontation or, because I can get quite feisty now. I've sort of built up this other personality in me. But also I am very conscious of, I'm empathic about those who are frightened. I am more empathic of those who are frightened and actually traumatised. The people who are more likely to be the most aggressive are the ones I've got more empathy for.
Well, that's really lovely. That's lovely. And it's in keeping with your background in therapy. That's a lovely thing. I should be ashamed because I'm looking for the confrontation, to be honest. No, I am. And it's not because I'm a bully. I'm not a bully. I'm a very big guy and I can take care of myself and I'm very fit. And I would never be violent to anybody. So there's no danger of violence. But I am looking for it. And I have, you know, a couple of people have approached me in recent weeks and asked me, and I've been really rude to them. I'm going to take a leaf out of your book now, and I'm going to be more humble and realise that these people have been screwed over. It's not their fault, and I need to be a bit... And that's how I naturally am anyway. But I think what it is I've become so disgusted and upset with the acquiescence that I see every person as the same, and they're not the same, but I see them as the same. I see them, as Vernon Coleman calls them, as collaborators, and I need not to do that. And I'm going to take a leaf out of your book. So it's a lovely way to approach people. They're still human beings with families, and the vast majority of them are decent. They're just scared witless, and you've done a brilliant job, and I'm not patronising you. You've done an amazing job of explaining why they're scared witless. And I'm not scared witless, but I've had some good fortune in my life. I've been exposed to other things and other people. I don't know the things I know because I'm a genius. A lot of that is happenstance and luck. So I'm going to take a leaf out of your book, Leah. I think that's a really good approach, that, you know. And it might alleviate some of these confrontations, maybe, which is no bad thing. We're going to run out of time in about 3 or 4 minutes. Look, I'm still, if there's a scales, the pessimism side of my scale is winning. It's the one that's kind of touching the ground. I just don't see how we can prevent what's coming down the line. And I don't want to finish up the last live programme of the week by depressing the audience or getting them all, you know, fed up and, ah, Richie, why did you say that? But I want you to give me some optimism.
Oh, I'm very happy to do that, because I know exactly where you're coming from. And I think a lot of the people in the resistance have really been cycling through this traumatization that we're suffering, because we're coming at it from a different angle. We know too much, and it can be very damaging. So my first tip to people would be to say, back off. Get off your social media, give yourself a mental break, watch a movie, do that chill out stuff. Do that as often as you can. But to come back to what to be positive about, what's happening in the last few weeks that is happening behind the scenes is there's an awful lot of professionals coming together in different fields of expertise, and they're collaborating, and then they're collaborating together. So it's a network. There's a network happening. It's not just in our country. It's across all countries. And it may have started with the German doctors and the American doctors and those kinds of people coming forward and stepping out of the shadows, if you like, and into the limelight and going, right, look at us. This is what we're saying. The Great Barrington Declaration has really helped the councillors I spoke to. I didn't finish that story, but they know about the Great Barrington Declaration, and that's giving them confidence that there's possibly something they can start doing and a way that they can argue. But what all of these different groups, including lawyers, including scientists, including doctors, including psychologists, I'm talking to a lot of them, what they're all doing is they're combining their skill sets, and they're bringing together there's bunches of these campaigns. There's lots of different websites where people will be able to get access to resources. I am working with others on toolkits to help you stay sane, but also to teach you ways that will give you some more confidence in what you're doing and how you're approaching all of this, and to also start to communicate with those who are more stuck in their mindset. But also just look at history. You know, I've talked to a few people of late who are far better educated in the whole sort of history side of things. But I live with a man who's obsessed with it. So I've been aware of the historical side of things for many, many years. And all I keep coming back to is, do you know what? Sometimes we just always win. Good always does come to the surface. It always has, and we always will. And at the moment, what's happening is the nefarious people in this world who are behaving very poorly and pushing this agenda that is going to afford them great riches, wealth, ego, power, control, whatever the hell it is they're addicted to, they have had to show their hand far more than I believe they were really prepared to, because there is such a strong resistance, because it is global, and because there are so many people now who are not prepared to tolerate this. So just hold, you know, stay the course, as they say, stay the course. There are good things happening, lots and lots of them, and you will get access to all of these different resources. All of us in the resistance, we will all share all of that stuff on all of our socials, and you'll be able to find out where these campaigns are. And I'm not talking about signing petitions, because we know that they tend not to go very far. It gives us a sense of doing something, but it doesn't really do anything. These are much more powerful. And you know what? When you really know what the enemy are doing, that's when you've got some power.
Leah, come back on the programme again. I'd love to have you back on. It's Leah Butler Smith on Twitter. L-E-A-H is Leah, by the way. Leah Butler Smith, a clinical hypnotherapist and psychotherapist, activist, doing a terrific job. I came across her, as I said at the top of the programme, on national television some time ago, talking about these issues. Great to have you on the programme today. Thanks for the optimism, Leah. And as I said, do come back. Anytime you like, come back.
Lovely. Thanks, Richie. Take care.
You too. Terrific way to end the week, I think. Thanks to Leah for that. That's more or less it for the programme. Stay in touch with me overnight on social media. I'll let you know about tomorrow. I've got a lot of things to do tomorrow. I've got a skip coming. Do you know what that is in America? What do you call them? Skips. I've got a dumpster coming. I've got a lot of work to do in the morning. We'll see how things pan out tomorrow. Thanks to Leah Butler-Smith, and thanks again to Tommy Sheridan, who was on the programme in Hour 1. Have a fantastic weekend. Look after yourselves and one another. From the BBG, myself, it's bye for now. Bye now.